Let us get settled. Mind your head. We are more than 10 minutes behind time, and I'm sorry to everybody for that. It was not our intention, but please do accept our apologies for that. And then, secondly, let us start with our meeting, and honorable members, Mr. Michael Tatalias, CEO of Southern African Tourism Services, Ms. Sianda Zondeki, Deputy Director General on the Inspection and Enforcement Department of Labor, and your teams, you are welcome. The intention of the committee, and that is the purpose of the committee, is to have hearings between two very important role players in the industry. That is, we have a hearing from the Southern African Tourism Services Association, and then from the Department of Labor. And then from there, we shall ask questions as members. So we are not going to have questions of clarification. We are not going to have a question after that presentation, but we shall go straight to the second presentation. And then the questions then will follow after that, and the deliberations. Because in the past, we allowed for questions of clarification, and then they became deliberations and discussions. So to try and avoid that, we shall have the first presentation, and then immediately after the first presentation, have the second presentation. But moving from a very successful mega event that was the 2010 FIFA World Cup, we have a challenge. How do we as a nation optimize the legacy that ensured therefrom? What do we do as Team South Africa, government, the entrepreneur, labor, civic society, in order to meet this challenge, given the fact that tourism has overtaken gold as a revenue generator in our country? How do we make sure that we even generate even more revenue, generate even more jobs, decent jobs, generate even more livelihoods, generate a more inclusive growth, generate more rural development, generate more funds for health and other social services in order to put our country on the world map moving forward, and for the benefit of everyone, black and white, rural and urban, men and women. How do we as a nation go forward together? These are the questions that are before us. Before the World Cup, we were worried about the managerial risks, about the reputational risks, about security risks. Those risks, I think, we mitigated quite well during the World Cup. Our reputation has improved. as a destination. People have seen different experiences of our country, but now, how do we make sure we improve on the numbers? That is the number of tourists coming from abroad, coming from Africa, and then coming from domestic tourism. Because if we do not stimulate that as well, our tourism will not have its full potential. These are the questions that we are faced with from where we are. So that is the context of our distinct deliberations and our hearing. It's not that we want to interrogate people that and the other. Our task is to oversee, to oversight, but at the same time to make sure that we do understand each other, where we come from as your elected panel. Then item number one, it's the presentation by Mr. Michael Tatalias, Chief Executive Officer of Southern Africa Tourism Services Association. That will be for about 45 minutes. That is the maximum. If you can do in a shorter time, it will be more than welcome, sir. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Honourable Chairman. Greetings, honourable members, and another guest.
Greetings, honourable members, and to the chairman, Mr. Dungamedi. Thank you very much indeed. I think it was very polite of you to apologise for running late to your members. It was in fact my fault, so I'll in fact take the blame on me, not your chairman. He was here on time. And we do admire that, and it's very naughty of me. In the tourism industry, we try very hard to be on time for meeting and respect to us. And if we don't, we name and shame them. So I'm naming and shaming myself. I went through the preparation notes on the invite, and I must just advise you, my mind is sort of in two places. I have a big national conference on Friday, and I've left the staff in the office doing things, and I think that's part of the whole thing of letting them grow. I'll go back and find what they've done, and probably when I've calmed down, it'll be fine. There'll be nothing wrong with it. But I've turned you down once already, so I didn't think it was fair that we should decline a visit again. So here I am. Just to go through the couple of things, you'll see there's two logos there, the South Africa and the Feel Inspired. That one's a little harder to see on the bottom right. It says it's possible. That's the new unified branding, which I'm sure Dee Dee Moyle has told us about on the bottom right. And the SA Tourism is very big for the last 2 years, IMC. We bought into this as an industry many years ago. In fact, they came to sell the concept of the flag. I think we've seen the success of the flag in unifying the country, particularly in the World Cup we saw it. I think, in fact, the World Cup with the flag flying, citizens saw that just by simply putting up their flag, they did their bit for making the event better. And now they're becoming much more active in everything. But before it became a sideways horizontal, it was that way. We already stole the logo a long time ago. So I've left it there because I do feel inspired. But that's the new and improved one, as you know. Just go back again. You can see there's also the TSI logo at the bottom left, bottom right, and then also the 40th anniversary one from last year, just to show the sort of pedigree. We've been at this proudly serving inbound tourism for a number of years. So SATSA, you see the logo right up at the top. The APSA one's there because they sponsor us, but it's the Southern African Tourism Services Association. And that means we've been going for 40 years looking after people who bring tourists into the country. Now, 40 years ago, that meant exclusively, virtually, dealing with foreign tourists who are coming into the country. The way of looking at inbound versus outbound now would be to say, what is an outbound person? That would be your travel agents, headed up by the ASATA, the Association of South African Travel Agents. They send someone away. Typically, your travel agent lives in the same town as you, and he puts you on an aeroplane and sends you someone. When you've left home, somebody needs to look after you, and that's when inbound tourism comes into it. So now we've changed our view entirely. We're quite a transformed industry in that respect. If you come from Cape Town, Lusaka, or London, we don't care. You're inbound. Somebody's got to fly you. Somebody's got to drive you from the airport or put you on a bus or a train. You sleep at a hotel, eat at a restaurant, go to some form of entertainment, whether you're going on tour or just to meetings or to conferences. Those are all our members. That's the inbound side of tourism. Established 1969, We tend to mark ourselves as the mark of quality tourism in Southern Africa. Again, the function was in the 60s, as international tourism was growing, we suddenly had a way of foreign guys are saying, how do I trust your destination? What you don't want to have happen is someone arriving and not being met, having paid a deposit in advance. So that's always a fear. I'm going to somewhere I know nothing about. It's miles from anywhere. I've paid my money up front. I get there and they run away with the money. So the way of preventing that, we created the association so that we could market to tour operators and travel agents overseas and say, deal with us with confidence. South Africa's worth coming to, and here are the companies we suggest you deal with because we've never had a problem with them. And I just put in there at the bottom, found a member of Tourism Business Council of South Africa with the SATA, the outbound travel agents, and FedHaus of the hotel groups. In 1987, we formed the Tourism Liaison Council, and that became a TBC, mainly because some of the ladies said, TLC, that's not exactly the branding we want for a hard-hitting business group. So how do we fit in? I think you've seen this slide before on the 18th of August when Mitsatsi Morobe, the CEO of Tourism Business Council, came. But that's how we fit in. TBCSA is the umbrella we all fit in. Each of the associations has a reason for its existence. FedHaus deals with hospitality, the SATA, the travel agents, SATSA, the inbound members, SAKI, the association for the conference industry, Savrala, for example, for the vehicle rental and leasing, SATIEC, for the youth travel. Each one of them has a speciality all of its own, and it's the right place for people to own, to belong to, because they will deal mostly with their own issues. You do find people members of all, but that's fine. They choose to play in the bigger pool. But we need to be represented to government, and so we've chosen the structure of the Tourism Business Council to talk to the rest. So that's, I come sit before you as not only the CEO of SATSA, I also am a board member and have been for the last 7 years of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. So often there's so many meetings to do these days, we'll take each one of it, and then no need for all five of us, or six or seven CEOs to be at a specific meeting. Two or three will go on a specific topic, and we can represent the associations broadly. There's some of the other logos you may have seen, the Saboa, Savrala, the Vacation Ownership, Satyak, everyone in there, just to give you an idea. Okay. This was our vision, to be most recognized and sought after good business practice in Southern Africa. Please note the name Southern. And right back in the beginning, we already recognized that tourists don't come to South Africa just to see a country defined by a geographic boundary. They come and see a number of attractions. So whether they come to see Etosha, Vic Falls, and Cape Town, in their minds, that's one destination. And so we've had members flying around and doing stuff in those countries, and so we've always been Southern, but with a predominant focus on South Africa. And yes, when I go to Rotosa meetings and I go to the other countries, they do give me a lot of grief for having the South Africa flag so prominent, but you know, in fairness, our brand is world internationally known. So they kind of live with that now. That's what we're trying to do, offer advice to people to get good advice and deal with the right companies and try and do lobbying to unlock the industry. We are a non-profit association. All our funding comes from membership fees, and we include members from large, small scale, everyone included. The interesting thing is, to become a member of SATSA, you have to prove that you do it. So we do a check, and you check it every year. You have to prove you have legal compliance. Are you registered with the tax department? You've got to give a SAR certificate, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all sorts. You've got to give a CIPRO documents. We want to know you're a proper company. We figure that if you've done the proper registration, your chance of being a quick in-and-out shark type person is not likely. You have to have the right insurance for the type of business you do, whether it be transport, whatever, and we check it. And then you've got to get certificates of that, and we check it on a constant basis. You've got to have the permits if you're in transport, for example. Whatever is relevant to the industry you're doing, you have to prove to us that you have the right stuff available. Now, sometimes that does cause us a little bit of grief because everyone wants to be a member. But we've gone with the principle that we want people to be registered. That's why we insist on the SARS registration, etc. So a sole proprietor is the right way to start a business. Your risks are lower, but you're not yet a fully-fledged company. You can't yet be a SATSA member. So we do insist that people be properly regulated and they're paying their taxes and contributing to the country. I think that's a fundamental, and it has been all our life, but it ties in with the national agenda. You've got to be contributing and putting back into your taxes. Now, the bit at the bottom you see the bonded, which you see on our logo, SATSA bonded. That's an interesting form of insurance, and it's a world first. What that is to take away the fears of foreigners, anyone really, but foreigners particularly, scared of paying in advance. Now, we did this a number of years ago before the economic recession, and it's proved even more valuable since then. So we have a small insurance fund paid for by our members. You have to be, if you're a member stats, you have to pay your bonding. It's 590 Rand a year. And what that pays for is if a customer overseas puts his deposit in advance, as you must before coming here, and the company he paid it into goes into involuntary liquidation, that customer can claim against the insurance fund. So it makes us compete against other countries because we feel a little bit safer about traveling to South Africa because there's a chance, if something goes wrong, that you'll get your money back. And we've seen in the last 2-3 years a number of big international tour operators going out of business. But it is a world first for, it's the first time done by the private sector. Overseas it's done on an outbound basis with government backing. So it's first time done in inbound, first time done by the private sector. Since then, Australia is looking at it, New Zealand's looking at it, and then the process of setting their own ones up, and Ireland already set theirs on. So we started a trend there. But again, fundamentally, the big guys are supporting the little guys. 500 Rand is a lot to them. But what we see in the way of the future is that most of marketing and tourism is starting to move online. And how do you trust the person on the other side of a website? You know nothing about them. This is some way of giving credibility, which then levels the playing field that a small operator can compete against the very big ones because he's got a similar level of credibility. Plus, he's being checked by SATSA. So he'll have a bonded and the SATSA logo, so it should tell the customer he's in safe hands. Committed to the transformation industry, way back before any of the BE codes came in, we've been looking for a way to do this. And one of the things we learned is that majority of our members are still owned by the entrepreneur who started them. So it's very difficult to get to the ownership before we got to the scorecard. The scorecards helped with a lot of that. But the entrepreneurs themselves weren't going anywhere. And they were trying to say, and we chatted amongst ourselves and said, how do you make a difference? And we all said, well, we've got 20, 30 years of experience in this. We should share the skills. And that led to the tourism mentorship program, where I'm not able to share my business yet, but I'm willing to share the skills and knowledge required so that someone else can start a business. And we did it in partnership. All of this is self-funded, as I say, through membership fees that we can't afford. We're not a wealthy, profit-making business. We don't have a product that we sell. So we have to do it with partners. And that's why we worked with the government. One started in the Western Cape. They were the ones who saw the vision. And eventually to the Tourism Enterprise Program, where I believe Mr. Sivapile also presented to you on this 18th of August. They came around later and joined with and held hands with us. We worked very closely with them. The way it was to find people with skills to put time into going through someone else's business on a full year period, go into the business, look at it, see what needs to be done, make advice, and sit with them for the entire year until they can get to where they need to be. And that has proved very successful, and we've rolled it out to a number of other provinces. The problem is funding, and so the provinces where the provincial tourism department or the provincial marketing body don't see the value, we're a little bit hamstrung, but we're still pushing ahead. We also run the SATSA tour operator course, figuring we're the inbound side, we're tour operators pretty much by definition. Who better to teach than us? So we do charge a fee for the time we're sending my staff around, but it's phenomenally cheaper than anything available. We, for example, do an intensive 5-day course. The most people charge around 10,000 to 15,000, and we just charge 2,500 to cover our costs. So again, we sit there, and that one has been taken up, particularly with the provinces in the lead up to 2010. There was a big demand on their scorecard for 2010 as what was their long-term legacy. And we've seen some of the guys with the more input through mentorship or through proper training right in the beginning, we find that the companies, the small emerging companies, do stay longer. Whereas previously, lots of people want to get into tourism, but it had a 2-year lifespan and then they were out. To give you an idea of the size of the combined one, we need to do this again. We did one back in 2006, inspired by FIFA. When we won the World Cup, in stroll FIFA and their friends match, and they said, so what have you got? And we went, we don't know. So we did a whole survey of our members, how many rooms, how many jobs, how many this, that, just to get. And suddenly we realized we weren't a small little industry that we thought we were at one stage. We were quite a sizable chunk. Direct revenues. And that's only 58% of the members providing information, which is a good return on result. Thank you. So that's 6 billion odd turnover, which I expect to have increased substantially since then. 25,000 permanent direct jobs, 33,000 beds and 17,000 seats in vehicles of various sorts. That's the direct turnover in our member companies. Remember, tour operators, often are smaller companies that place a lot of business with people like hotels who have the much bigger employment. But they're the conduit. They're the guys who have the expertise in marketing in the rest of the world. So these are really the feeder jobs and companies, and they put the business into the turns out into the broader tourism figures that we see. Just to give you an idea, transport's jumped a bit to the right. It won't be the first time. Just to give you a sort of a split, the RS accommodation, but the tour operators and the DMC destination marketing companies and management companies form the bulk of the members. Often you'll find why is an accommodation company a member of SATSA and Fedhaza? Well, the operations director will sit in Fedhaza and argue about things like liquor permits, this, that, whatever, labor issues, whereas the sales and marketing director sits inside SATSA because these are the tour operators bringing business. It makes a lot of sense to network and make and work with them. And just a little breakdown, we do still have some overseas members. Again, a lot of guys overseas feel very good about working with us because they can trust us, and they can find out industry information from the source so that they can do their job of selling South Africa. We work with a number of overseas agencies, for example, ATTA, Association for the Promotion of Tourism to Africa, and then those sort of guys. So just to promote the message of good quality product, reliable members, and the fact that it's working. Right, just wanted to go through, because I'm sure someone's going to ask how bad is the economy. Other than the big event we did, and the big event we did in June, July, big events we did last year, it's been a tough year. 2008's financial crisis, whatever you want to call it, downturn, had a major impact on tourism, as you would expect. People travel when they're happy. People who've got money in their pockets are happy. People who don't have money or might not have jobs are not so happy. So that is a bit of a challenge. And let's just see, go through some of it. All right, there's a forecast. It's always amusing. The top arrow right at the top, January 2008, I love forecasting. They'll tell you what they want you to believe. No, it's only going to be a little thing. Oops, by August it's going to be a big one. By November, we were really bad, and by 2009 became really bad. See, they're all still predicting this graph, which I've kept for that reason, to show we'll bounce straight back again. Well, we haven't. We're still far below the levels we were, and we think we can only expect on a world basis to be back in, getting back to health by 2011. From a South African point of view, we have been better than the world, as we know, mainly due to the exposure we've got with the World Cup. So, and I know inside the tourism industry, we were very cross with that New Zealander who lost us the World Cup in 2006. But in actual fact, if he hadn't died, we should give him a medal now to say thank you for making it last to 2010. There's some figures I'm sure you've seen just to show you 2007, 2008, dropping. Although the blue line, Africa, is interesting. There's some more rivals, but again, that's an interesting split. There's some parts from the rivals from Africa who spend into the industry, and there are others who don't. Very good for the country that these African rivals do come because they spend money in checkers, game, and whatever, and they do big investing and trading. That's fantastic. But for the purposes of spend into the tourism industry, that's our challenge. How do we get them to do it? But we are seeing it coming. For example, when I came across to get to us today, I traveled from last night, and I came across on the Gautrain, and there were a number of Zimbabwean and Zambian-type traders with their big bags of luggage who were taking the Gautrain, and they were very proud of it. They had their cameras out and filming themselves. And I said, being me, I just chatted to them. I said, no, they got small loads, so this time they could go, because what they tend to do is they fly in with the low-cost airlines because it's just them coming, and then they got all their goods, they get on a bus, and they head back again because they want to go. They need to see their goods going through the border post. They don't trust our customs and excise when the goods are over there and they're over there. So that's their model, fly in. So already they've changed from busing in to flying in. Give them the right product, and if we can get the right price for bulk cargo in the aircraft, I'm quite convinced that they're quite happy to travel. So there was someone who'd gone all the way to Sandton to get on a train because they were proud of what Africa had already done with the car train. So I think that's just a sign that if we find what the African markets are looking for, I think we'll get more value out of them in spending to South Africa, but it's going to take money for research. And that's a constant one, is with all the national budgets dropping, one of the ones we must be very careful we don't drop, as in any business, is the research and development. And SA Tourism needs very carefully to have lots of money. We don't understand what potential is out there in Africa. We've done a little bit, but we're way too short. Domestic, they haven't done enough research on domestic. We haven't done, by any means, enough research on Africa. You've seen the contribution, I'm sure, to the GDP in terms of 3% directly and 8% combined. Significant employer. I think one of the things we're trying to get across to, I'm sure you guys are already aware of it, but I think we have to share that our colleagues in Cabinet don't always understand this tourism thing. So I think we're going to have to be partners to sell it, because I think what they need to understand is that there is labor. I'm sure the presentation by the Department of Labor said it may not be ideal labor yet in a number of circumstances, but people are getting jobs and keeping them. And that's an important aspect. Again, from SA Tourism figures, WTTC figures in terms of the sort of size of contribution. I just like that figure. By 2008, a million jobs, but I think realistically by 2010, when we get the figures from them, we'll probably be back around the 900,000 jobs total. Now, if you compare that to manufacturing and textiles and all those kind of things, where the job losses have been massive, I think tourism's performed quite well. But I'm looking forward to the labor stats, because then we can get some of the latest ones. Now, this is a figure just to give an example of why we have to work very hard to unlock the barriers that are blocking tourism. If we go with 2.1 million arrivals, high-spending flying guests coming in 2008, the reason there is a focus on the international guest who flies in is that they spend a lot of money, and that's what we need. It also brings in forex into the country, and it stays here, which is excellent. So if you assume that you go with the figure of 1.8, if we see a 10% decline in overseas arrivals, that means we're going to lose 27,000 jobs. So every time we have a drop in arrivals, that's a fairly significant figure, because it means we lose permanent jobs. Not seasonal ones, we will still get seasonal, but I think our drive is to try and get permanent jobs. One, it's the right thing to do, and secondly, you can work on the quality of the staff and the skills that they possess. We find that the cycle of high season, for example, Cape Town in December, you hire temporary staff in August, September, train them up, they do the season, and they go into something else during winter because there's no jobs available. So we train them up, they've got a good way of working, so they go to the spa, and now they're better employees at the spa because of the experience they've had, but they've lost to us. So we start again in the next September with brand new staff. Those hotels that have managed to keep sustained staff, you raise them to another level, another level. We saw in the investment leading up to the World Cup, was keeping more staff so we could have a better quality, and they did us proud in the World Cup. So, practical experience, what's the it meant? Our forward bookings went away. We used to have a nice business. We had 6 to 12 months lead time. You knew who was coming and you could prepare for it. I remember the December in 2008 was very nervous. A lot of people phoning me from the industry saying, are there any tourists? Is it just me? Tourvest, the largest of the inbound operators by a large margin, on the 1st of December, they were on record to have the worst Christmas period in 15 years. And by the 15th of December, they were having their best December, because suddenly the customers doing what they now have become the pattern, lastminute.com. They know, they research a year out, they've kind of decided where they're going to go, but with the financial crisis, they don't want to guarantee their money up front. Maybe they get retrenched, maybe their company closes down, they have to find. So they'd rather have the money in the bank for the rainy day. When you get to sort of a month before the holiday, then you say, I'm still employed, the company's still strong, let's take money and go on holiday. So lastminute.com, so it's putting immense pressure on the inbound operators in terms of being able to respond very quickly and deal with it and having the confidence to go out there. So we're in new times. We're learning all sorts of new things about tourism that we never knew before. Standard practical guide, look after your cash and your cash flow. I've been accompanied by Mr. Munton, who's the SATSA's National Transport Advisor. A canny operator has been in the business for a number of years, and he'll tell you straight from the beginning, if you don't look after cash, you don't get to his age. So, straightforward, simple. You've got to be very careful. And what we're very good and important about sustainability, one aspect of sustainability and transformation is to keep the businesses we've got, to keep the jobs we've got, so that they can grow into the future. New businesses all the time isn't a good thing. We've got to continue growing. From a structural point of view, what has it meant? Well, we've got to make it easier to do business. Immigration issues are an issue. But I think when you ask us, in the industry, what is it do you think are things that are going wrong? Key things. When we started in tourism in 94, we had about 600,000 international arrivals. We've now got 3 million, close on 3 million, plus, if you take the broader regional and domestic, up to almost 10 million this year. That's a massive growth. But what it did is, to get there, we had to talk amongst ourselves with government and say, okay, who's responsible for what, and then we go out and do it, and we check on each other. Now we're at the stage where tourism has grown to the point where I think most of the bottlenecks are outside of the tourism sphere. Now, when I say tourism industry, I'm not just talking about the private sector. We see the government role players, the departments, sitting with us in our industry and working together. Most of the problems sit beyond them. Transport problems, immigration problems, visa problems, etc., air access. There's all sorts of things that need to be coming. Skills development. I've done set our friends from the Labor Department because, well, they don't belong to me, but you can be nice about people now because they belong to higher education. But there's problems there. So all these things are making it difficult to do business in an already very, very difficult time. But there's opportunity. And one of the key messages we're talking about at our conference, and I wish some of you could come, but if whatever, I will make to you available the presentations that I've delivered for your committee as well, so you can study. But one of the key ones is Professor Matthew Lester from Rhodes University is doing a talk about beware tourism industry, the RAND is going to be strong for the next 3 years. Fundamentals are right. We spent 6 years and 40 billion rand selling ourselves as a country to the rest of the world to tell them we're competent, capable, and bloody efficient. Now the rest of the world believed us. They're putting their money into South Africa and the RAND strong. Get used to it. Prepare your business to compete with the rest of the world from a strong RAND. My members are going through this. Now they look, they got through 2010, they raised their head above the parapet and they're getting shot at. And it's not easy. One of the big problems is the foreigners who send business take out forward cover on their to protect their exchange rate. So the prices we gave them in May at the Indaba are pretty much locked in. So I'm sure we can do deals to bring it down, but you're certainly not going to be able to raise the prices. Make your businesses even more efficient. But the good news is our businesses on average, I think from a private sector running the business side, are running at about in the top 20. If we can get used to pricing right, we'll be in the top 10. So if it works for a South African, it's going to work for a foreigner, price-wise. If it works for an African guest, it's going to work for a foreigner. We've got to get our pricing right. It's going to hurt a bit, but it's all about making our businesses even more efficient. That's that graph again, just to show you why we think Africa air arrivals are exciting. They're coming for a few days, but they spend the most out of the days that they come. And we think there's a lot of scope for that. So let's get all of Africa onto aeroplanes and coming into South Africa and buying, shopping, spending, and generally having a good time. I love that he's in this example just to show you what you can do. This is East London. Remember, before this, we had SAA going, flying the only aircraft into East London, a relatively small airport. And everyone told you, no, there's no point investing in East London because no one goes there. Most of the transport went by bus or by rail. Well, that worked up until we had open skies and we allowed some small operators, whether it be Kalula Mango one time's kept it up, and a couple of the other ones are going there. If you look at the growth you see on the screen, you'll see quite spectacular numbers of increase due to giving someone a cheap, efficient, fast, simple-to-book system. And the interesting thing is the numbers didn't disappear on the landside arrivals. The landside arrivals are still the same. So East London benefited. Sure, that has a lot to do with their growth in the export market of Mercedes. Sure, lots of other businesses manufacturing in the Buffalo City area. But the point is, unlock the air access and numbers start to move. And a significant chunk of that are still domestic tourists going there to spend. So now you've got a sustainable tourism, if somewhat seasonal, but if we expand it, it can grow. The same works for any other city in South Africa. The same works for anywhere else in Africa. If you compare Livingston to Vic Falls has two carriers, SAA and Comair. But they're quite expensive because they're the only two. They haven't got competition. They charge about 3,500 rand to fly there. One time flies to Livingston, just the other side of the river, and they will do a three-day package, including accommodation, including activities and flights and transfers. Funny enough, landing in Zambia and sleeping in Zimbabwe, so there's a transfer through the bridge, for 2,800, full package. Guess who's busy? So unlock the opportunities, and we can do wonders. And so what we've got to do is open up our air access into the rest of Africa. And if you do nothing else, lean on our colleagues in Durko to be pushing this. The Yamoussoukro Declaration in Africa is important. Right, now that's, I used to say thank you. I used to, for the last 6 years, we've had that clock counting down. Counting down, counting down. And it was fantastic because it kept us focused and boy, did we deliver. But this is what we could start to say. Done it. I didn't go to the final. I chose to give my tickets to members of the staff because I thought they'd done fantastically well. But for me, the most important game of the tournament was to be in Soccer City at 4 o'clock on the 11th of June 2010. No one can ever tell me we can't ever do it again. I just never want to hear someone say that again, because I'm now going to thump them. I've been rude about that in the past when people said we couldn't do it, but now I've got some proof. I couldn't resist just showing fans enjoying themselves. You saw the three ladies, the photographs of the orange ladies. That's the infamous ones of the ones that FIFA had, didn't they? I just thought it was fantastic. Ambush marketing, when it was. And there's old Shabalala. Almost pulled it off. But anyway, we did it. And I think being focused on the future and having a big common goal worked very well for us. From a tourism perspective, it was so big we had to work with partnerships. We had to trust our staff and let them free to interact with it. And everyone talks about what's an authentic experience. I think authentic was defined by the people of South Africa enjoying what they wanted to enjoy. That's the definition for me of authentic. Selling and working in the experience that you can sell because you enjoy it yourself. The world came and they saw us. Now, we've never had a problem in the past. All our tourists, 99% of them, always enjoy it. So I don't know why we thought, or people said they wouldn't enjoy it, but they really enjoyed it. What was nice is for the first time we had urban tourists who came to party and be with South Africans. I think we're at a point where now the country understands what tourism looks like. Previously, they don't see them because they're in the game reserves. And I think what is also good is the effective oversight. You talked about your own role as the committee. I think that everyone was concerned. Everyone was participating. I think it was a constant effort for the last 3-4 years on top of everything else, plus good planning, plus a very good industry that we were able to deliver. I must point out, it's nice to have international words like effective, efficient, and capable as definitions of South Africa. The success is due to everyone's effort. But I do have to say that if we had the numbers we originally anticipated, I think we might have struggled a bit more. So maybe that was a slight blessing in disguise. The major reason we put it down to is economic climate. People just not willing to travel or scared to book in advance. And we saw a lot of rush bookings. As teams started to do well, there was a lot of interest in coming to us. Also exposure to a lot of number markets. But the pricing was an issue. The market did drop the prices, and therefore we got more people in. But the high pricing initially, plus the economic climate and the long haul, made it unlikely. If we'd had another 100,000, 150,000 foreign tourists, I think we would have struggled, particularly on the transport side. So it worked very well. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes backstage stuff. So be it. We did it. Any theatre that you run, you'll know in any industry, so long as the audience don't see it, it doesn't matter. The audience didn't see it, and the audience, the big audience, was the 20,000 journalists who showed the world that we know how to have fun. We did it. It's done well. So how do we go forward? What do we use it for? Well, here's my thought. I don't know if any of you have seen these photographs of the private jets on Super Sunday, as it was, the last day in July. That's Lanseria. Okay, we at some point maybe want to talk about King Shaka. There was some on a Wednesday before. My take, and I've done a lot of research on the King Shaka one. Durban handled Brazil, Portugal 2 weeks before. Handled it fine. No problem. The plans were in place. The difference was a couple of things changed. One, the Brazil game, people could come in for 2 days before because they were following their team. The semi-final is always day after the day, so everyone, or a significant 30% of the stadium, was in Cape Town the night before and had to move to there. That's risky. There's a reason FIFA insists that their teams be in the city the night before the game in case there's a problem. It makes sense. That 2 days next to each other is always a problem. We had a weather problem in Cape Town, a wind shear problem for 45 minutes. Stuffed up the departures because a lot of aircraft fly around the country. One aircraft, if you plot its movement, like a Kalula aircraft all the way through the country, will go to about 9 different airports. They get reused whenever the cycles are. So they were busy clearing out to Johannesburg and from the sort of early two runs in the morning to Joburg, then they were going to focus on flying to Durban. They got out late, so therefore they started loading late. So by 11 o'clock, we were an hour behind. Now normally, I, flying into Joburg, see it probably a bit more than you guys, but you just get home at 11 o'clock instead of 9, your wife's grumpy, you kick the dog, but no one actually cares. This time you have irresistible force, a running airport running late, with immovable object, 8 o'clock kickoff. You've got to work with that. FIFA doesn't change for nothing. Now, go back to the 1995 World Cup rugby. I don't know if you remember it. We almost drowned against France, and we just beat France to get into the final. Okay, there were all sorts of stories that they were putting out on the TV about, you saw the ladies sweeping the fields of water. Well, that was a PR spin. Because the rain had closed the airport, people couldn't get in. They needed to delay the game by an hour. Okay? Rugby being what it is and not as linked into 3,200 billion people around the world, rugby could do that, but they had to spill the story about the water was too deep. They were worried about the players drowning in a ruck. Not true, but it worked because you had the visual thing of people sweeping water off the field. So So on the rugby one, we got away with it. Okay, things happen. It's fine. Also, semi-final in Durban. For those of us from Durban, we'll forgive you. But what did happen is, in the process of running an airport, you can shuffle, and the King Shaka Airport is bigger than the old Durban Airport by a significant margin, more parking space. You can save about 5 minutes an hour to 10 minutes an hour if you just turn things around faster. The other airports help. Instead of, for example, being an hour turnaround in Oliver Tambo, they'll turn the Durban-dedicated aircraft around in 40 minutes to 45 minutes. You can do it. So every hour you click back 15 minutes. Till about 6 o'clock, they should have been back on track. What changed with these private jets at King Shaka? No space to park. NOTAMs did make sure that they gave off on Tuesday, saying you must, on a small aircraft, relocate the aircraft to Durban International. Four did not. Two had permission given on the day to stay parked. And that meant that King Shark Airport did not have four passenger bridges, which would have been much more useful. To park an airplane over there, put people in buses, bring it in, slows the turnaround. To have a bridge, but you can put a big 250-seater aircraft in, so you can load them straight to the bridge, turn it around and send it away, we could have made it. When you have an operational plan, and I don't know who gave permission, and I don't think we'll ever find out. I'd love to know, but anyway. The important thing is when you have an operational plan, the operational people run the show. You may be the biggest boss on the planet, you may be FIFA, you may be someone from India, I don't care who you are. You don't change the plan unless you're the operational person. And that's what happened. Someone interfered without seeing what was on the chessboard, and then stuffed up the chessboard and took four blocks away. That's one of the big things we learned for the future. Don't change the operational plans. We spend 6 years planning, stick with it, and it'll work. And it almost worked anyway. So well done to King Shaka for actually making it work despite the delays. But the important thing I like to see about this one is you have Oliver Tambo and Lanseria, separation of duties. Big aircraft in Oliver Tambo, parking space because it's two runways plus extra space for all the little jets in Lanseria. That's a city that's got a plan that's working. Good. The other thing is I keep this photograph with me now because this makes me excited. That weekend and the week before, we were the number one A-rated party in the planet. Paris Hilton doesn't know where South Africa is. She doesn't even understand soccer. But she knew, because she's got a finely tuned sense when she's died. Well, she knows where the drugs are. She's down the wild coast. But she's got a finely tuned sense for where the world is looking. She'll always go where the media focus is. If Paris is coming, amongst others, it means you had to be seen in South Africa. I have no clue what you know, but they all went away loving it. We were the number one A-rated party. We can do this again, and we can do it regularly. So I have a little thing called 2020 Vision. Past that. And there's something to go through. There's Usain Bolt in the bottom right-hand corner, smashing by a significant margin at the Beijing Olympics. And there's another one we should be bidding for, the Commonwealth Games. I've just put out the Durban 2020 because I think it's the city best located. Our president comes from the area, that helps. But given that it also is the winters between July and August is when it happens, they're terrified of high-altitude games after Mexico in 1968. From a basic point of view in terms of temperature and everything else, Durban's perfect. The Moses Mabhida Stadium was built with an electrics track in mind, so it's already, we don't have to build a new stadium. You've got the other stadium next door. You've got the Olympic swimming pool across the road. We're already running championships there. You've got a whole area of land where we can develop. You've got the railways right there. You've got the harbour, the water for the water sports. And you've got a developing airport, which will be even bigger by 2020. Everything is in place for Durban to be a successful bid. If you go and look up on Wikipedia and look for Olympic bids, funny enough, South Africa is at the top of the list. The rest of the world thinks we should be bidding. Unfortunately, and I'll send you copies, people in Africa and in South Africa doubt our ability. I actually think if we won it now, we could do it by 2016. But we didn't bid for it. Brazil were cleverer and more confident. They got the soccer for 2014, they got the Olympics for 2016. Well done. But if you learn from their strategy, just start bidding. Bid for everything. And you'll start having a stream of these big events. Not just because big events are good. They are. They raise our profile and they give us something to aim at making ourselves better. So I think we need, as a tourism industry, we're desperately keen to get tourism involved. So again, if you could lobby with your sports counterparts. The problem is the bid has to come from SASCOC. I hope they've learned from dealing with Custer Simeon how not to run an event. But the bidding is now starting right soon for Commonwealth Games 2018. That's seen as one of the provers. So we should be going for 2018 for Commonwealth Games, 2020 Olympics, and keep going. We need to help to get them to understand. They need tourism to get us in the bidding process right at the beginning. I'll just put that slide in the top. You see Delhi 2010 in 33 days' time. That's their Commonwealth Games. There's the Kumi is a tiger, obviously the tigers of India. But isn't that something we've seen before? Are we ready? Well, yep, I think we are. My 2020 vision, I've gone back to my aircraft when we were the number one A-ranked party in the world. Top 20 ranking by 2020. I know that in parliamentary cycles it's a 5-year one and the minister and you guys are probably all focused on the next election. But I think as a tourism industry, we didn't just win the World Cup in 2004 when we won the bid. We actually started bidding for the 2006 one, lost it, and kept going. That was a 15-year process. We can do it in 10 if we start bidding now. Durban is hosting the IOC next year, so we should get that all in place. We should be a leading player in the T20. You know, you've heard of the G20 Economic Group. The T20 is the first one that's hosted in South Africa, the Tourism 20, the top 20 tourism nations. And our minister is very clever to go and steal that one. I want to do 20 million tourist arrivals by 2020. We can do this. 1994 we did 600,000. By 2010 we did, should say 10 million, not 1 million, not 1 million. 10 million, sorry. And, sorry about that. wrong version. Sorry. I gave the wrong one. Top 20 employer of choice. I want the employees to vote. I don't want them to leave the country because we've seen now as an excellent employer of staff who go around the rest of the world. And maybe we can get the Olympics by 2020. But if you take 20 million tourist arrivals, international, regional, and domestically, we can actually do it. Right, that's my thank you. And yes, we'll keep the flag flying because we believe it's only beginning. Now, in your process, you also asked me to talk about crime and tourism, so I have a very, very short one. Okay. Can I just open it up and show you the one slide that does count in Tourism Safety Initiative? I think it's in the pack. Is it in? Prints out? I haven't had a chance to look, but let me just show you one thing that is causing a problem for us. And why we set up the Tourism Safety Initiative, not to be because we're clever, just because we need to do it. And someone had to do it and affect our business. And we work with all partners. So we call it the Tourism Safety Initiative, the TSI, not because it's SATS's. If you call it yours, no one else wants to help. So it's open for everyone in tourism. It's now become a project of the Tourism Business Council. Affects us, you know, the size of the job. This is the important one. If you look at that graph, I'll leave this one with you. This and the next one. SA Tourism did a study of the top 10 markets as to why people don't come. And they went and found out that a number of people look at South Africa, want to travel long haul, do travel long haul to our competitors. It's not someone who didn't fly at all. It's people who did get in an airplane, but they didn't come here. Over that period, we lost 22 million people over 5 years. If you break that up, that's 4 million people more who could have come. So even if we only converted 50% of them, that's another 2 million people a year. If at 2 million people, we were already employing a million jobs, with 2 million more people, 3 million more people, we could have had another million jobs. That's a 2 million job industry. Now, I must tell you this because I don't want this to become a debate on crime. It's not crime. Safety includes crime, but includes health. So at that stage in 2005, we had the AIDS debate, cholera. Those sort of things do make people nervous. Water quality is a big issue at the moment. Again, that's outside of tourism, but we need to lobby water departments because they have to fix those sort of problems. Here in the Western Cape in particular, when it's rainfall in KZN, for example, some of the river mouths are clear. In Cape Town, in some of your river mouths don't flow, and that's when you build up all the problems and flood wash down the rivers. So health and safety are big issues. Quality of the driving, again, the Department of Transport, we have so many accidents in our roads compared to the rest of Africa who's dropping and we're not. People are concerned about being able to drive. So it's a total package of safety concern. But crime is significant. But here's the exciting thing. We proved in 2010 we can come up with a plan and we need to support the police department and the armed force, that whole cluster that worked together. Our tourism safety project manager, Anli Barkerman, was the only private sector person to sit in the National Joint Operations Centre in Pretoria. She sat through the entire World Cup as the tourism. There was one from the Department of Tourism and one from TSI to advise them on tourism interaction because it was a tourism program. We've proved our ability to work with them, and that entire plan they came up with must be applauded. So I think we've seen the lowest levels of crime we've seen around the country for the last 10 years. We told the people we can actually win this war, but we've got to work together with the authorities. And Tourism Safety Initiative is what we've done. We had a database of knowledge to share with the police to make tourism safer. come. And I think if we do the study at the moment, I'm waiting for SF Tourism to give me, over the last 5 years, we've actually missed out on 30 million people. And that's close to 3.5-4 million people a year we could have had. We could be in a 2.5 million job industry. Now, if we go back to our colleagues, I know tourism is seen as a little thing, and I, with no disrespect to you because I sit in it as well, I think other things are seen as more important, more glamorous in cabinet. I think you can quite confidently talk to your colleagues in parliament and say, hey, we're a 2 million job industry, if you could just help us unlock the problem. And isn't that what they're asking for in cabinet, to create jobs? The more people you come in, the more we can get into the rural areas, the distribution. All of those things happen with more customers and more repeat customers. What we do find, those who come back go more rural and they spend much more money. So we want our guests coming back again and again and again. All right, I'll stop at that point because that is just to leave in your mind that we are working as an industry on safety because it is a big issue in our lives. I'll go back to my pretty one. So I'll try to switch these off now. That's me. There are a couple of other issues. Key blockages, all that. Maybe we can do those as questions afterwards where we see big challenges. But I think that gives you an overall idea of who SATS is, our role in the industry, and how much we're willing to partner. We have partnered lots with, and we want to partner with you as well. Okay. You asked me 45 minutes. I've saved you 1 minute. David will tell you that that is phenomenal for me. Unheard of.
Thank you very much for an exciting contribution.
Going all day, sir.
And I'm sure that you've got a 2020 vision, a good 2020 vision. That's why you're not wearing glasses.
No, you're not.
Okay. Let us have 3 minutes to stretch our legs and come back for the next presentation. While they are cutting out the let's take half a minute and get settled, please. Okay, let us continue, and our presentation will be from Ms. Sianda Zondeji and Mr. Vix Mukwatle, Acting Chief Inspector on Enforcement Services in the Department of Labor, and who Ms. Sianda Zondeji is Inspection and Enforcement Services. In fact, here we are going to look at how they assess the conditions of employment, survey before 2010 World Cup. We are going to look at their findings and their recommendations. I think that is the broad mandate. And then how it fits into the whole scheme of things. Over to you, Ms. Zondeji.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. Thank you for invitation. The purpose, in terms of the structure of my presentation, you've already touched on the purpose, and we accepted the invitation and request for us to come and share some information. Chairperson, I can't help it. I think I just need to inform you that maybe our first target for inspection will be my friend here, Mr. Tatalias, in terms of employment equity. I'll briefly touch on the background, the legislative framework that mandates us in terms of our business as the department, our daily inspections, the scope of our inspections per clauses, and also on the recommendations as requested. Just on the background, what are the historical facts and the current facts? Our country is a tourist destination of choice, and the industry is the first contact point and exit point for tourists. The sector, we believe, also it consists of very small and micro and medium enterprises. In terms of the industry, it is one of the growth engines of the South African economy and the fourth largest generator of GDP, following manufacturing and mining and quarry. The sector is booming in terms of economy and it's sustainable. And we believe that the tourism sector plays a significant role, not only in the economy of the country, but also in building a positive image of our country. Hospitality industry is one of those which supports tourism in the country, because hospitality is what we focus on. Internationally, there's a growing demand for patrons to support establishments that respect and uphold human rights and dignity of workers. In order to protect the image of the sector, sound labor relations are very important. And Chairperson, here I also want to just mention the pillars of a decent work agenda, which are the promotion of rights of workers and upholding of labor standards, social protection, health and safety, and social dialogue. The purpose, you have already touched on it. In terms of the legislative framework that mandates us in doing our work, we have a sectoral determination, which was introduced in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which sets minimum conditions of employment and wages. we have Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act, because workers get injured at work and they are entitled to compensation. We have the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which ensures that there's a healthy and safe environment for workers in any workplace. We have also the Unemployment Insurance Act, which we know that the temporary loss of income, and when workers lose employment temporarily, they are entitled to unemployment insurance benefits. In terms of our daily inspections, we have a vision to ensure a conducive labor market that creates jobs, that promotes labor standards and worker rights, and ensure investment. The department is not a job creation department, but we have to ensure that the environment is conducive in the labor market for job creation and investment. Through our daily inspections, a total of 2,622 establishments, that is workplaces, were visited in the hospitality sector in the first quarter of this financial year, so which is 2010-2011, out of which 1,493 workplaces complied with our legislation. I've mentioned the legislation that we enforce. There was about 56% non-compliance, and our target here, Chairperson, is to ensure at least 70% compliance with our legislation. So you can see that we have a challenge here in terms of compliance to our legislation in this industry, that is hospitality industry. In terms of our blitz inspections, and we regard this as being proactive and preventative, our daily inspections are informed by complaints that we receive or requests to go and inspect, but we also do proactive work in terms of ensuring that there is compliance. We have identified hospitality industry as one of the high-risk and problematic sectors to be inspected for this financial year. And during these inspections across the country, we inspected 2,583 workplaces, with 1,377 workplaces found to be complying with our legislation. So again, we can see the levels of compliance with our legislation, which shows that we have a serious challenge in terms of compliance. During our inspections, the following observations were made on the following. These are just the clauses in terms of what we look for when we go out for inspection: the minimum wage levels as determined in the sectoral determination, the calculation, deductions, written particulars of employment, because workers have to have contracts of employment, work on Sundays, night work, and daily rest period. In terms of the minimum wage levels, employers are not aware. This is our findings now in terms of the inspections that we conducted. We found that employers are not aware of the annual increases, and this would lead to underpayment of salaries. And then in this regard, we try and secure undertakings with employers, which we issue for them to correct whatever that needs to be corrected. And these increases, in terms of the sectoral determination, we have increases in terms of the rates of payment. In terms of commission that is being paid, although the majority of restaurants employ on a commission basis, they neglect to ensure that the employee still gets the minimum wage in the event where the commission end is not the same as the minimum wage. The commission structure is sometimes written in such a way that the employee would not understand, and this creates confusion. And we must also take into account that the type of workers that we're dealing with here, and mainly it's vulnerable workers, people who are not highly skilled in some instances, where we need to ensure that they understand what they enter into in terms of contracts of employment. In terms of calculation of wages, employers have a tendency of calculating wages on a monthly basis, but in the determination, it's clear that there's monthly wage, there's weekly wage, there's hourly rate. So it needs to be calculated in accordance with that. Thus, having a fixed number of hours per month, irrespective of how those have been calculated. Because, again, hours were accumulated. Although the normal hours of work are stipulated, again, in the contract of employment, the only time overtime would be considered is when those fixed hours for the month have been exceeded. Employers have been asked to fix this problem with the payroll administrators and not use that as an excuse. And claims for overtime were submitted to the employers because in many instances, overtime is not paid to the deserving employees. Although pay slips are issued to employees, the information supplied on the pay slips, again, it's problematic. There is no clear breakdown in terms of providing hours of overtime work or public holidays. When interviewing employees, it was clear in most cases that they had no clear indication of how the employer came to the amount paid out. In terms of the deductions, when employers issue uniforms and work clothes, they will deduct a certain percentage of the employees from the employee's salary and keep this as a security in the event of the employee absconding. The Act, again, is clear here that under no circumstances can an employer require or permit an employee to pay the employer in respect of the supply of any work clothing. The employer has a responsibility here to ensure that he or she provides protective clothing for workers if that is required in terms of the work that is being performed. In terms of the written particulars, when employees commence employment, they are offered contracts of employment, but they are not provided with copies for safekeeping. And this is what we inspect. It's part of the documentation that we look at, because the contract of employment will detail the conditions under which an employee is engaged. And this would lead to unnecessary friction when both parties are interviewed by an inspector, as he or she would get different interpretations of the content of the contract. Employers were issued with undertakings in this regard to ensure that this is corrected. And again, why we require that contracts of employment be clear. When a dispute arises, then it's a basis, it's a document that forms the basis of our resolving the dispute. In terms of the compressed working week, employers would request workers to work two shifts per day with a rest period of 4 hours in the event of other working workers being absent. And they would then average the hours to 45 hours in a week. This is a contravention in terms of the rest period of 12 consecutive hours in terms of clause 17 of the determination. Employers, again, were instructed to stop the practice as it creates a high risk of injury occurring due to fatigue. Because workers would become tired and make unnecessary mistakes which can be avoided. Sometimes those mistakes result into serious incidents which could have been avoided. A clear explanation, again, is given on how to prevent In terms of work on Sundays, employers still regard Sunday work as an ordinary day in terms of payment made for that day work. Although the clause 14 is clear in that it must be paid at 1.5 times the employee's wage for that Sunday work if the employee ordinarily works on a Sunday. This wrong perception is due to the interpretation of the old wage determination of the sector, and we know that currently, if employees work ordinarily on a Sunday, they are supposed to be paid 1.5 times. But if they work on, so if their Sunday is not their working day, then it's a double payment. In terms of the night work, this industry requires that a high number of staff members are available to perform night work. However, employers would not compensate for these hours worked, and it was explained to them that there must be an agreement between the two parties on the amount or time off in lieu of the night work. I'm saying here employers generally, but I've indicated that we have inspected specific employers. So I'm just saying employers generally. But information is available in terms of the specific employers that we inspected, in terms of the restaurant, the hotels, that we, the B&B, the guest houses that we inspected. As explained under clause 12, the rest period of 12 hours is not adhered to due to some instances absenteeism. The employers were requested to find alternative ways to deal with the problem instead of asking the same person who worked earlier in the day to return in place of the absent worker. This was especially prevalent in restaurants and kitchens where only one cook or chef is present. And this is in terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. And with regards to occupational health and safety, in most cases where we've inspected workplaces, the contraventions pertain to the non-existence of electrical certificates of compliance as well as general housekeeping. And also the appointment of health and safety reps, because the Act requires that we appoint health and safety reps in our establishment. In terms of the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act, the contraventions here were mainly around the establishment being registered with the compensation fund. And these were addressed, and undertakings were issued for this to be rectified, where we'll assist in terms of ensuring that the establishment is registered with the compensation fund and also with the unemployment insurance fund. And in this regard, again, the contraventions were around registration and inability to provide proof of payment, because when the employer deducts a UIF, then that means there needs to be proof of that, and also we need to ensure that it's being paid over to the fund. And again, in this regard, we've secured undertaking. Just to mention here, Chairperson, that you hear me saying we've secured an undertaking, we've issued a contravention notice, and in our legislative review and amendments of our legislation, we're looking at strengthening this area, because now we believe that it's 16 years down the line in terms of implementation and adherence and complying to the legislation. We need to be strict now in terms of enforcing compliance to the legislation, where we're going to be looking at the penalties and also the fines to be issued where non-compliance is found. In terms of the recommendations, we therefore need to make sure that this sector encourages all the industries or entities that are crucial in supporting its growth to ensure that worker rights are observed. We believe that where there is a healthy and safe work environment, where there is respect of worker rights, where there is upholding of labor standards, there is a productive workforce, and therefore the business thrives. There are no incidents where there's a result of lost time and absence in terms of absence of an injured worker or even fatalities in this regard. This will surely galvanize everyone to support efforts to boost the tourism in the country. And we also recommend that we hold joint inspections with relevant enforcement agencies in order to promote an integrated approach in ensuring compliance to legislation and uphold good labor standards. And this is what we have done, as I've indicated, that we've conducted these inspections in the first quarter of the year, and we've collaborated with Home Affairs, because during or prior to the World Cup, you will find that there's a lot of people employed in restaurants and in hotels, some of them in the country illegally. So that's where we needed to ensure that people are in the country legally, they are employed in accordance with our legislation, and they are not exploited, irrespective of where they come from. When they are in the country, they are protected with our legislation. And it's when all we all work together that we can achieve more. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Now, yes, in fact, we have looked at the whole distinct environment now. That is the labor environment and with its challenges. And it is over to you now to ask questions. First, Mr. Kumo.
Thanks, Chair. I have a question to each presenter. It can't be easy for Ms. Sondeki to come before us today in the current environment where people are trashing the country and undoing a 43 billion rand investment and even murdering people in the view of the Minister for Health by allowing sick people to die and making sure the babies don't get fed so they die too, and then lecture us on how employers don't heed to the law. It's got to be the worst possible circumstance to have this presentation. But it is surely made even more offensive by putting a party political slogan at the end of a presentation. I think it's entirely inappropriate that we have an election slogan at the end of a government department presentation, and it has no place in this committee. It has no place in this committee. Having said that, it is a fact that restrictive labor legislation and legislation that makes it very difficult to start a business, particularly for someone who is risk averse, is actually creating unemployment in this country. The presentation today is a litany of complaints about people who are transgressing these labor laws. And that's fair enough. We all have to comply with the Constitution. We all have to comply with the laws. What I would have liked to have seen in this presentation is some kind of sympathy for the fact that it is actually very difficult to start a business in this country that's labor dominant, because one feels that no matter what one does, it is so difficult to comply with everything, and it is so time-consuming and expensive, it's actually not worth the effort. Hence the drive to capitalize and to actually have a smaller labor component as possible. That is the situation our country is at the moment. I wonder whether Ms. Sondeki perhaps can at least lighten the mood a little bit and tell us, in all of this enforcement and all of these draconian laws that employers feel isn't worth the effort, is there some way we can at least come together and actually make it easier to comply and actually make it more of a pleasure to hire labor and build the country and create tax bases and things like that, rather than it seeing as a very sort of negative experience? So that's my question to the Department of Labor. By contrast, I'd like to thank Michael Stratus, who's a very positive and very can-do attitude in his presentation. I really felt very proud as a South African sitting here and being reminded again what a fantastic job we did during the 2010 FIFA World Cup, and having gone to many games and having participated in every form of the World Cup that I possibly could in my oversight role, I can only endorse the comments that he made about how well it was run, with one exception which he did mention at the end. And I'd like him to comment on AXA, because in my view, Chairperson, it was inevitable what was going to happen in the semi-final. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't something that may or may not have happened. It was always going to happen. Because I actually think AXA are one of the worst-run departments in the country. They're worse than Home Affairs, actually. Home Affairs at least improving. AXA is getting worse. And it's not as if there weren't prior warning signs that were flashing very loudly or brightly. The British and Irish Rugby Lions Tour, AXA got it spectacularly wrong in Cape Town International Airport. People fighting and hitting each other because they're missing their planes. I was there. I asked parliamentary questions about it. When AXA came to testify to this committee, I asked them, are you going to make sure this is never going to happen again? And we got a glib and bland assurance that it wouldn't. When we conducted the oversight tours, one of the places we visited, and you were there with me, Chairperson, you remember, went to Mbombela. And I don't know whether you were on the tarmac with us when we were told that unscheduled flights would not be a problem. Okay. I was told to be quiet because I was told that an unscheduled flight was a transport issue, not a tourist issue. And I pointed out that tourists actually are on those planes. So it is actually a tourism issue. Anyway, I was made to be silent by the people who ran the oversight visit. But afterwards, employees took me aside and said there's over 1,000 unscheduled flights during the Confed Cup, and it was going to happen again, and please could I do something about it. The Michael Patelis spoke about the Brazil-Portugal game. I agree, I also was at that game. I actually arrived late because we took off late from Cape Town, also because of AXA. I missed the first 15 minutes of that game. As it turned out, it didn't matter. It wasn't a game where if you were late, you missed very much. But the point is, the next day was a problem. And the next day what happened is that people queued for over 2 hours at QN to fly to OR Tambo and then catch a connecting flight to Luanda. These are the Portuguese people who flew in for that game, right? And the reason why that is that AXA didn't provide enough staff on that morning for the check-in counters. Okay? And the reason why that is that on a weekend, because that was a Saturday morning, there's a 30% absenteeism rate, which they never told us in any of the committee hearings and didn't get right for that game either. So 112 people, I'm told, missed their connecting flight to Luanda. In fact, there was some media coverage about it last week. But I interviewed several of those people at the airport and on the plane. And the morale at King Shark International Airport amongst the SAA and AXA staff who do work is rock bottom, because they know that when they're expected to work over a weekend, one in three of them aren't going to pitch. And it's always the same people, and they are powerless to do anything about it. So it's a really big problem, which they haven't addressed. Okay? There was other flights where Honorable Farrow also had his flight cancelled because of bad bookings. Now, what I believe this committee needs to do is to actually bring the CEO of AXA here and ask him, how is it that you can get private airplanes, have to file a flight plan, and yet you don't have the power to say no or to redirect them to the old airport? Because as we've heard today, it was because of those extra private flights that we lost our 15-minute catch-up time and allegedly 611 people, I think it's closer to 1,500, missed the game because of that. So I think that's a really serious problem. But what I would like Michael Taylor to comment on is his experiences of AXA generally during the British and Irish rugby tour, Lions rugby tour, the Portugal-Brazil game, the flights that were cancelled, and just generally the meltdown of morale at King Shark International, the fact that at OR Tambo, AXA have to replace their ramp handling staff every 6 months because 25% of their staff, they tell us, are dishonest and 50% are corruptible. So then 6 months, 75% of them are stealing. Hence, we still have twice the international standard of pilfering from luggage at OR Tambo. What do we think needs to happen? Does SATSA have a view on how somehow we can interact with ACSA and get their problems right? Because ACSA actually were the weak link in the 2010 FIFA World Cup.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumar. Let me try and redirect the meeting. We are dealing with the activities in respect of job creation and sustainable livelihoods on the one side. On the other side is access and conditions of employment, survey before 2010 FIFA World Cup, 3 your findings and recommendations. So if we sneak something in, it should be for a reason that is in line with this framework, please.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Kwara.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me first welcome the 2 presentations. Very straight to the point. Very encouraging. But one need to emphasize, to try to clarify, we are not really in a party politics arena here. We are in a multi-party committee. And we need really to behave like that. I don't see personally anything wrong when the presenter ends his or her presentation with this phrase. It's when we all work together that we can achieve more. I want the sense of the political party thing to be played there. I don't see it. But I'm sure if we can direct the House, maybe to refrain from that, we really, this committee will go further. Secondly, Chairperson, we have alluded to one that I wanted to raise, the issue of the ACSA and other things. Maybe I don't think they belong to this committee at this point in time. Let me ask the first question from the presentation from the CEO of the SATSA. I don't know if it will be your mandate or is your mandate to tell us how do you see or how do you assist the SMMEs or the rural people to become fully fledged organized organization or to belong to your structures, because I believe we still have people from the rural area whom they wanted to be also fully fledged organized in this sector. The other questions from this presentation by labor. Indeed, I wanted to encourage labor to really make sure that the enforcement should be there and practice in full force. You see, the presenter talked about 15 years in democracy. I'm sure we have made a mistake for 15 years not making enforcement to this. We have really underperformed our duty as members of parliament. Because I'm saying this, Chair, my own sister, this year only, if my records are still okay, since from May until date, she is working for a white person in Joburg, who's dealing with this PNB things. She has now 3 months without seeing her own children, her own men, and her family. She has been working 24 hours. When you call her, she's always at work. I called her when I was at the game on the 11th of June. She was at work. I also called her on the 11th of July. She was at work. Really, it shows that the question of enforcement in this country is taken so light. And I'm sure as legislators, we need to do something and need to empower you to make sure our people are not misused. It's not only for my own sister. We go to the rural area, to the small town. This happened very seriously. People are used like nobody, especially in terms of the payments. People are getting, I don't want to call it a peanut, it's not a peanut, the money, because they sometimes assist their children of that. But then it's a money that they cannot survive. they cannot even go to open any account to buy a finish or a tool for a kid. So it means the enforcement really is too serious and must take it very seriously, especially on Sundays. Belief of us in South Africa, Chair, is that on Sundays it's a family day. Our own people, and they don't enjoy the family day because they're always at work. How on earth are we going to rectify this and make sure that our own people are also deserve the best in this country? I'm sure, Chair, it's very important to get this presentation from these people from the Department of Labor, and we need to encourage even the Committee of Labor to deal with the matter of the agency that it deserves. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I didn't mean to, but I think I should. the last part of the presentation from Labour. I thought that first bullet there, that very last page, which is talking about the need for joint inspections with the relevant enforcement agencies. I thought that was very relevant and very correct. But it is true. I also noticed, you know, that the second bullet is now really, in my opinion, actually spoiling that. Because I think that first bullet is enough. You didn't need that first bullet at all. I mean, it's a fact. We can't deny that. You know the ANC slogan. Who doesn't know it? We know it. So I don't think that we should deny it. But I think what we should say is that let's continue the way we have been working as a committee. I think our chairperson is very well balanced in terms of how, for instance, he conducts the meeting. I don't think we have any complaint about that. But anyway, this is not from him. It is about the presentation. I thought that what Mr. Kumbok was doing was just to make the presenters aware, you know, of what we expect as a committee. We are one committee here composed of different party members, but we work as one. Now, the question I have for SATSA says it is committed to transformation and sustainable development of the tourism industry. Now, I want to, and then, of course, in order to implement that, they go on to say that they form partnerships with emerging businesses. I had been looking for this, but I got it. That you do it by forming partnerships with emerging businesses, and I think you say you go to the extent of actually assisting them to see that they meet the challenges. But what I wanted to find out was, you know, you are such an old organization, 40 years. But since 1994, there has been this emphasis of also assisting those, the part of our society that has been previously disadvantaged. Now, I wanted to find out from you, what challenges do you actually find in assisting that group of business people? You see, those who are previously disadvantaged, that is, if you are assisting them at all, I take it that you are. But what challenges do you find? You see, challenges, for instance, which you did not find, say, before 1994. Now, to the Department of Labor, I see almost all the inspections. You end up by saying the employers were instructed to do this. The employers were told to do that. The employers were told not to do the other thing, and so on. Now, I wanted to find out, what are you going to do in order to ensure that they have actually done what they have been instructed to do? I don't seem to get that in the presentation. You did say towards the end that the department intends to be strict. But can you get the the actual definite action that you intend to take in order to ensure that there is a follow-up. Because for me, it remains hanging. It's fine writing up, but then it remains hanging if there is no follow-up to ensure that these instructions have actually been followed by the employer. Now, coming back to this part about a joint inspection, and then, of course, you mentioned home affairs and the question of non-South Africans, you know, in the hospitality industry. I mean, this is a fact. When you go to these restaurants, you cannot but see that quite a good number of the people who are working there doing, you know, the ordinary jobs, waiters and so on, are non-South Africans. I don't know. You see, I don't want to be misinterpreted as a person who is xenophobic, but I do get worried about us not seeming to be protecting the South Africans. You see, because when you talk about it, you go on to say the employers have been made aware of the fact that they have to ensure that their workers are registered. In other words, to ensure that they are legally employed. There's nothing wrong with that. But the extent to which this is being practiced, in my opinion, it needs a more action rather than protecting, you know, the workers. But what about those who want the employment and are South Africans but are not getting the employment? We all know the reasons why, for instance, most employers, not only the hospitality industry, but, you know, even the farmers too, they do it because, one, they know that non-South Africans are very desperate for jobs. They are in a foreign country. They're not going to complain, even if they are paid very low salaries. They won't complain. You see, that's one of the main reasons for that. Number two, that the non-South Africans will not necessarily belong to the unions, to the trade union movement, and therefore the non-South Africans will not, for instance, be involved at times like we have now, you see. So for me, I think it needs a much, you know, firmer and more definite action than saying we tell the employers to ensure that their workers are registered. I'm really dissatisfied with that kind of approach, you see. You see, it's exactly one of the reasons why, for instance, we will continue to have, you know, this complaint from a certain sector of our community about what we interpret as xenophobic action. I think we, in a way, we also encourage, intentionally or unintentionally, we do encourage it, and it happens. Personally, I have been to countries in Africa, lived there for many, many years, and I have seen how, for instance, the governments of those countries protect the citizens. We have to protect the citizens. We have to find ways of protecting the citizens. As I say, I might be interpreted as being xenophobic. I'm not. But it's because I have seen it. I've got many examples that I could give in various aspects of life about how even the African government have protected the citizens of their own country. We don't seem to do it in South Africa. We just leave it open like that. And, well, they must ensure that their workers are registered. And we end there. It is not enough. It is not enough. Go to the restaurants. You will see for yourself. Who is there? I'm not jealous about those people getting jobs. I'm happy. Many of them I can actually communicate with them in their own languages. But what about the locals who get isolated and are not being employed? What are we doing about that? Thank you.
Makwanya, Bene, Maluleke. Ha, 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 ha.
Okay.
Mangani.
Mangani.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine is just, I'm concerned. I'm talking to labor. Occupational health and safety. This is a major concern, especially in South Africa, here in our country. Most people who get injured, those who are working around the hotels, motels, and guest houses, they get injured because of this non-existence of the certificate for license to find out their business is not properly, especially the electricity is not properly placed. So this issue, I would like the department to investigate it thoroughly and put pressure to those who doesn't comply with the, those who doesn't have the certificate. I understand you said this year it was the first quarter. In the first quarter, you did do the inspection. My question is, how often do you go around and do the inspection? And then the third one, it will be when you do those inspections, how many forces from your inspection that you deploy to rural and farms? Because we've got guest house in the farms, we've got guest house and motels also in the rural. Your joint inspection, when it was that your inspection was that successful? If not, what were the challenges, except those ones that you said you give them warning? Have you seen your working together with Home Affairs will assist this country to alleviate some of the shortcomings that we are having? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I want to check on the Department of Labor, where they say out of 1,493 complied with the legislation, and there was 56% non-compliant. We don't know 56% of that number, if you can give us a number. And the other one is that, did you give those non-compliance a time frame to comply with the legislation? The other one is that it's important to monitor those challenges, because if you can look at people who are working in restaurants, they are like beggars. If you don't give them tips, they will look at you and you will feel shame for them, and they are working. So they show that they don't get enough money. And also the issue of days, because most of women are the one who look at jobs to look at children and everything. So it's important that they get some off to look at children. If you work on Sunday, it's up to you. It's that you want money. Sunday is like a day that you will go in a voluntary to get some money. So it's, I wanted to say it's important that labor must check those things. Thank you, Chair.
Let us now give
time for response, firstly to SATSA, and then to the Department of Labor. Over to you, Mr. Tatalias, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Gennady. Shall I just answer my sequence of... Well, okay, because I see the one unfortunately is out. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I would like to speak again with you guys at some point, because the thing about working together, you know, the questions to the Department of Labor to work with other departments, I think we have to accept that, as I said, that the problems of tourism often sit outside neatly of our definition of, and the same with Home Affairs, as I say, Labor is finding that some of their problems are sitting outside their department. You have to work together. And we do have to see that tourism is integrated, unfortunately, with so many, so it's not always a clean answer. So the first one I do want to talk about is in response to the question from Honourable Mr. Comeback. I missed some of the other names. I do apologize if I get them wrong. You put me in an invidious position to have to talk about AXA, but I'm not sure I would claim them as the worst one, but they have their problems. And it's one of the problems that we have within the Department of Transport throughout, in the greater or lesser degrees, is the level of skill. In certain of the land transport side ones, there's absolutely no skill at all, particularly in the provincial operating license boards, and certainly regulatory testing places, the people who develop the acts and regulations in the department. AXA on the whole, compared to the rest of the Department of Transport, is one of their better ones. And I know that in your comparison compared to Home Affairs is getting better. It's a shocking indictment on the Department of Transport that AXA is one of their best ones. Most of what AXA does, they get right. The things they get wrong, they get horribly wrong. AXA, in fact, the successful side is the engineers who build the buildings. They deliver on time, in budget, and on, which is unusual for building. It's a trend of South African construction. The problem we have, though, with AXA is when we run into problems, again, outside, inside, and this control of the baggage handling and the ramp handling is something we're very concerned about. We want to work with them. One of the key things perhaps the portfolio committee can do is to get them to give you regular monthly figures that you can analyze in committee, maybe not for public, I don't know how you do it, to actually see the comparison of the last 7 or 8 years of process of a baggage theft to the process. It has got a lot better, but it's still not right, and there are problems. And I do feel for certain of AXA there, because they do hire staff. There's no way of checking up them. When you do, you find actually they were fired from previous ramp handling type companies where they were fired for, but they weren't fired. And that's where it comes down to, if the processes, maybe if we could make it a thing we can learn for the future, if it was easier to go through a disciplinary process, more companies would do it. That gets it on their record. So a lot of employees get to a situation they've been caught for theft. It's very difficult to discipline them. So the company does a deal almost, and the AXA is guilty of this as well. They just sent off and they agree to go. Never goes on their record. Someone else hires them, and within 3 months they've learned that, hold on, this guy was a specialist on baggage theft. He's gone from company to company to company. So we need to work for the future as to how we do that, because it is an onerous process of going through the disciplinary. So again, it's a labor issue, again, how we work together to solve that. On the key problem for AXA at that weekend, on the Wednesday, the key program wasn't the landing slots, it was the parking of the aircraft. And where four of the aircraft, two had permission, and two just locked up the aircraft and left. And those four aircraft parked in key slots on the apron. So landing a slot is a landing time is a 1 minute 38 second process, 5 minutes to taxi, offload for 10 minutes and out again to reverse that. It's a 20 minute process. There were the landing slots available. ATNS did not do the wrong thing. They were acting on what the capacity of the airport to handle flights if they obeyed. Of the four flights, at least one of those hadn't filled in a flight plan, which isn't really a problem. It is in a process that you can do. It's just very difficult when you're under huge pressure. Is that the plane radios from about Port Elizabeth onwards to identify itself to King Shark, say, wants to land. ATNS looks at what's available. Yes, there's slots. Assuming that the aircraft will obey the rules thereafter, offload the passengers and relocate to another point. That's what didn't happen. This is an overruling of the operational plan. And that, I have to say, there's mixed bags within AXA. When they do stuff, they work pretty hard, and then at other times they make illogical decisions and overrule their own staff. And so that seems to be a bit of a pattern, not just with AXA, but you see that way. the absenteeism, I don't know how we work with the Department of Labor on this one, because that's a massive problem. If you're setting up a critical skills business, and where planes will crash and die if you don't have the staff on hand, to have them not arrive, so 33% of the staff are not arriving, I mean, that's almost, you need to close the airport down, it's too dangerous. But then everybody's not going to get to their game. So I don't know how we deal with that one, because I really would like to work with them. So long as ACCEP puts us into lessons learned how to go forward, I think we can make it work. In fairness, again, we worked with them on the air-land interface for 2010. It took a lot of effort. There was a lot of willingness and certainly more senior managers to solve it, and a lot of lack of skills of understanding land transport at a lot of the airports. Eventually, we got to make it work, but it took us 2 years of hard, hard effort. Again, we've got the models going forward, so again, that will work for us. So it's a sort of a bipolar relationship with ACCEP. When you find good, you find really good. Where you find lousy, they're just struggling to capture skills. But I think some of the management may have something to do with it. I would be very keen to hear what they have to say if they have to answer to. And I do understand that technically they belong to transport, but an airport, a fully functioning airport, has a material impact on tourists. It is the first thing they see. You've done, for example, SA Tourism does a fantastic job to market the country to the world. The airlines do a fantastic job. So everyone's running around looking after them. The person's left. Then they arrive at the airport. The experience can make or break the entire visit, whether it be, again, Home Affairs, SARS officials, so that Immigration and Customs can be outside of access control that can negatively affect the airport. So I think the total picture is that you guys do have the right to go and talk to them, and they should need to speak to you on the tourism impact of running their business, because they are dealing with customers' money. I hope that answers you. The Honourable Member asked a question about rural development. It's one of the biggest problems. Often, we don't get involved right at the beginning when helping people give advice on whether they should set up a business in the first point. Unfortunately, too many people have gone out, maybe at a political level, maybe at a newspaper level, saying tourism's easy and that tourism could be run anywhere. And that's not entirely true. The best way that I can compare that is to look at platinum mining. The Bafokeng are a very fortunate tribe and grouping because they have platinum under the earth. In the same way, we need to understand not all rural areas have tourism under the earth. You can only mine platinum if it's underground. What we've got to try and do is see what opportunities do exist and to advise people. But often what happens is businesses are set up and then they go ahead and say, why are we not supporting them? Because they're too far, the wrong type of business and the wrong type of customers who come that area. They don't match the customer to the potential experience. So we need a lot more advice at that point. The problem is there's an association. We're dealing with voluntary. Mr. Munson joins me. He runs his own business. He's donating his time free. I don't pay him to come. I'm the only paid member here, and we only have 10 employees for the whole of SATSA. So it's always done up on time. And we need cooperatives working with government departments, such as the provincial tourism bodies, who have development funds, to partner with private sector right at the beginning to design the right product, to make sure that the businesses have a chance of going forward. We do a lot of things. One of the there are a number of projects that we do. One of the key ones we've done recently is, again, partnerships is when it works best, working with South African Tourism to create the speed marketing process, where we're taking our big inbound operators, SA Tourism funds, we identify them, SA Tourism flies them up for 24 hours into an area, and they get to meet 150 products. Now, why does that work? Because in a very time-poor industry, we were under intense pressure to take 24 hours out to go and see an area is good. To have to drive around for 3 weeks to study a new area just is not possible anymore. So what we do is there are lots of good products available is to get them to come and speak. And it's quite a simple one. We get them, about 20 operators, fly them in. They sit down and listen. All these people come out and do a five-minute presentation. No slides, no anything, just on the personality. And then get through and you say, I like that guy, or I like that lady, I like that product. And then you send your research guys into the area and say, go and see, talk and do a deal. So those are the kind of things that you try and do partnership and link. When people start talking to each other, business starts to flow. Okay. But the problem is rural areas, again, funding, getting people to it. I think what we'd have to do is see it as incremental. If you can get the tourists where you are and you can stretch it a little bit to another area, then you can stretch it again in a year's time. But to go too far, it's very difficult to support it. We tried to set up our program in the Northern Cape. And the problem was there weren't enough mentors, and that's really the trick. Speak to the Honourable Mark, is to match a business person with one who wants to learn, and if you get them to talk. The problem is in the rural areas, there's not enough businessmen already. So we need to do it close from the areas where there are businessmen out to an area. And what we found in the mentorship program, after 2 or 3 years, the people who were SMEs who survived the 3-year process often make very good mentors, and they're very good at teaching because they experience it so much themselves. If we go too far, trying to find mentors is a problem. So that is one of the problems we have. Other challenges, funding to do the training. Not funding for the businesses, funding to do the training, because that is really a problem, because it's all being donated, but we still have to get people across. Red Tape in Tourism is a very good report. I'm sure maybe your committee is aware of it, the Red Tape in Tourism, done by Comark Trust, and we can forward it to you for your study. There's so much red tape on tourism that it's immensely difficult to start any business. Now, what sometimes is amusing, but actually is very sad, is a young black male entrepreneur should have all the advantages of BE legislation, what have you, is actually often crippled by the amount of other laws that make it difficult to exist. Even, in fact, to score more than the base level of entry on a BE scorecard because he's male and whatever, if he doesn't employ enough middle manager, female, etc. And most people go into business with not enough business skills. South Africans are very good at marketing, selling, talking to the people, talking to the tourists. That's where their skills are automatic and instinctive. What they don't have is the business background. And there's so much paperwork that the guy stops dealing with customers. He's spending his entire life doing paperwork and paperwork and paperwork badly because he's not very good at it. And it takes up a much more significant chunk of his business. And we find that the SMEs will go through a 2-year cycle. 90% of the SMEs we've worked with in the last 15 years have failed. And it's not a color issue. It's just there's just so much going against them. And the worst part of it is, there's a structural one, is that SMEs are exempt from skills levy. Now, that's good because that's another outflow of cash that they don't need. But the problem is, you cannot now claim training from your CETA. So the very companies that need the most from the skills levy process are the ones who can't actually do it. So there's structural issues. We've got to think about the whole CETA concept to find it. Inadequate school training, that school leavers are not coming up with enough knowledge to run their own businesses, and answers further other questions that go problem. And we just have to recognize, from a rural perspective, Cape Town and Joburg, your two dominant arrival points. We need to think in terms of concentric circles from there first, get those bases sorted out in the rural areas around them, to go on from there. One of the other significant ones is other government departments not doing their jobs. Could be the Provincial Operating License Board not issuing road transport permits for 2 to 3 years. For a small operator, that's a crisis. It means he has to go in every 2 weeks to get a temporary permit, or has done up till now. If the permit boards did their job, he would be able to get a permit for his vehicle if he qualified, get it and get on with the business. But otherwise, he has to not pay money, come back for temporary permit, temporary permit, temporary permit. A big company has a staff member allocated for that. A small company only has the entrepreneur himself. So when we have departments not doing their jobs, it's a problem. For example, we've worked for 7 years to get the National Land Transport Act to have a tourism component, and yet we can't get the Department of Transport to give life to it through the National Public Transport Regulator. We've been in contact through our minister and the tourism minister. We've taken this up for a year and still having problems. So that is one of the biggest problems. We want to partner with you is to find out how we can get our colleagues in other departments to do their jobs properly to the benefit of the smaller companies. I think that answers all my questions. My only concern is the question on Sundays, and this is probably going to make me unpopular. The one problem we've got to be concerned about in this entire debate, and that's why I think it's got to be a relationship where we talk more between the departments with us, is what do you do with your customer on the Sunday? Because if you're flying in somewhere and you know where you're going to eat on the Sunday if you're out, if the hotel doesn't have any staff, the restaurant. So we've got to find a model that works within the laws of the land, is fair to the workers, and yet is also fair to the customer. I think the problem is we're not meeting enough here. We're not catching each other, because I'm just as concerned as you about the abuse of workers. It's a problem. And that's why I said my vision for 2020 is to get to a point where we have decent work, but that works for the companies and the customers on the other side. If we can come up with that, A, we'll have done a miracle, because we'll be the first place in the world that's done it, so nothing small is my ambition. But we need to work together. I hope I've answered all your questions. Sorry, I didn't go by name because I think I answered them in collective.
Yeah, I think we need to work together.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you, honorable members, with your questions and comments. I acknowledge the fact that we're coming to present here during a very difficult time where it is a strike, and also I think I need to indicate that the department cannot condone a unruly behavior, unbecoming behavior, but the fact is it's in the law to strike, but people need to behave in an acceptable manner. I acknowledge that fact. I also acknowledge the fact that there are employers who comply with our legislation, and there are those who are really willing to comply with our legislation, and we cannot run away from that fact. On the same vein, I need to indicate that there are those employers who flout the law, who we need to work with in terms of assisting them to comply with the legislation. I accept the fact that, especially with the SMMEs, it sometimes becomes difficult to comply with our legislation. There are issues raised in terms of administrative burden. They come as some forms that they need to comply and complete and all of that. And this is an area where we undertook as a department to work with them. It's in our program to work with particularly the SMMEs, where we conduct information sessions, we educate and advise employers and workers in terms of the provisions of our legislation. And again, it's in our program for the year to ensure that we conduct these information sessions and education and advice. Our approach in the department is not just to conduct inspections and be there for the sake of policy. We first ensure each and every police inspection that is conducted is preceded by an advocacy session, where we create awareness among our legislation in terms of ensuring that both employers and workers are aware of their obligations and their rights. There is an Employment Conditions Commission which has conducted an investigation in the sector, and they have issued a report which in many of their findings, they talk to the issues that I've talked to in my presentation today. And the investigation is carried out in a form of public hearings where employers, employees, and civil society organizations are conducted. We accept their views. They are required to make submissions in terms of what is proposed in the legislation. And I take it that this report is available. It's for public consumption. And again, in this report, some of the issues that they raise, like the industry being a job creation industry that created a lot of jobs, it's labor intensive, those are mentioned in the report. During it was in 2006, the department conducted a labor market review, and we held a roundtable discussion where business was represented, labor was presented, and government was represented in this roundtable discussion. And we're looking at our legislation in terms of its flexibility and its rigidity. And the issues that I've mentioned in terms of the cumbersomeness of our processes, and if you look at the CCMA and our enforcement in terms of our legislation. And what came out of this exercise was the fact that there is nothing wrong with our labor laws. They are good and they are sound. The only area that we need to attend to, which is a challenge, is the weakness in terms of enforcement, which is why now we are looking forward in terms of in trying to strengthen our inspectorate to ensure that the law is implemented and we enforce compliance to the law. And again, that's where we were calling for a joint effort instead of a silo approach where we work alone as a department. We need to work together with other government departments, relevant stakeholders and other organizations in order to ensure that we achieve our objective. In terms of what is the department, the question around what is the department is doing in terms of non-compliance, we issued a contravention notice and secured undertaking. In terms of the notices that we issue, employers have 60 days within which to comply. So we give them that period, that 60 days to look at the areas that we've pointed out so that we then, after that 60 days, we make a follow-up inspection where we look at what we have raised and how it has been addressed. In terms of the compliance order, where we issue the compliance order, we again give the employer 21 days within which to comply with the legislation. Then we do a follow-up inspection. Again, if there is no non-compliance again, then we prosecute. And the Department of Labor doesn't have courts. We have to prosecute through the courts of law. And this is where, again, we're making a call to work together in terms of ensuring that we achieve what we set ourselves to achieve. With regards to and what we have done this year, because we again identified a gap, to say we don't go back to employers and give feedback and say these were our findings. Now we're holding seminars in terms of giving feedback to employers that these are our findings and this is how we need to work together in terms of assisting each other. In terms of the foreigners employed in the country, yes, it's a fact that they are employed, some of them, illegally in the country. But in terms of the law, everyone is entitled to fair labor practice. So when you are in employment, you are protected by the labor legislation. This is where we work together with Home Affairs in terms of ensuring that they need to get work permits. We need to indicate that as a Department of Labor, there is no skill in the country in this particular category, occupational category. Therefore, the employers can then source out skills from outside the country. But again, we're trying to close the loopholes. That's when we are putting the Public Employment Services Bill in Parliament for promulgation, because we need to ensure that employers report vacancies to the Department of Labor so that we can then do the matching of skills with those vacancies, because people register as job seekers. So we need to match the skills available in the database with the vacancies that are available. Where there is no skill in the country, then the employer is allowed to source out the skills outside the country.
Sorry, Sir Person, what did the presenter call the bill that is being put into Parliament?
So through you, Chairperson, it's Public Employment Services Bill. With regard,
is that going to be limited to the public service, or is it going to apply to everyone?
It's going to apply to everyone. It's not yet out. It's a Public Employment Services amendment. It's going to come from Labor, from the Department of Labor. With regards to occupational health and safety and incidents of non-compliance, the injuries that occur, we've taken note of that.
That's why we've targeted these, some of these industries, because we've identified that they are problematic and there's high risk of incidents and fatalities. In terms of how often do we conduct inspections, I'll ask Mr. Mkwatle to deal with that one, and also the capacity to inspect, particularly in rural areas. In this area, we have acknowledged that we are lacking in terms of the capacity within inspectorate. Hence, we are putting forward the request for additional funding to beef up the inspectorate, and we're hoping that we'll receive a favorable consideration in terms of ensuring that we get additional funds to beef up, because we don't have enough capacity. The inspectors that we have in the country, it's about 800 inspectors. And you can imagine these inspectors need to inspect all workplaces that are there. And in terms of the International Labour Organization, there should be one inspector per 20,000 enterprises. But if you look at our numbers, you have one inspector per 100,000+ enterprises. So you can see the gap, the gap there in terms of capacity. In terms of joint inspections, whether they are successful, again, I'll ask Mr. Mkwatle to talk to that, because we have instances where we conduct joint inspections with Home Affairs, with police sometimes, and also with agriculture and other departments, government departments. You'll also talk to the 56% non-compliance and the time frame. I have taken note of the comments, because I take it that some of the issues raised were comments. I've taken note of the comments raised by honorable members. In terms of working together, if I can address the concern through you, Chairperson, from the CEO, Mr. Tatalis, in terms of how to work together with the department, I think we will accept the invitation, because as I've indicated, that we conduct workshops for employers, we conduct workshops and training for workers with regards to our legislation, and also maybe it's an opportunity when you have conferences to avail a slot where we can share information in terms of what the department does and how we can work together. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson and members of the committee. Let me take this opportunity to add to responses that have been provided in this regard. I deal with the question that asked, how often do we do inspections? In terms of the Department of Labor section where we do inspections, we've got 9 provinces, and then the inspectors are placed in all the 9 provinces. And then in terms of the location, some of our labor centers that we have, we do have labor centers, and then their spheres of operation or coverage definitely does cover areas, in rural areas. Now, the openness of this, the inspections, we do inspections as per the record, we said we do inspections, daily inspections, and we also have police inspections. Now, the inspection, the daily inspections that we do inspections in terms of when we get complaints. In other words, your inspections that we call reactive inspections. So we get complaints from members of the public, as well as employers. Where we do get this, the request for inspection, we go out. And in terms of the police inspections, then we formulate a strategy or a plan of saying how we're going to respond. Now, our police inspections are also proactive, but then also they can be reactive in the sense that we, in terms of the plan, we react to the steps that we receive. Now, part of the information that we utilize to determine our police inspections as a response to the issue of orphanness is
on the basis of the claims that we pay out as a department. Remember, I think when workers get injured, the claims are processed through the COIDA, in other words, compensation on injuries, or the compensation by the compensation commissioners. Now, out of the stats that we obtained there, then we determined to say, but there's a likelihood that there's a challenge in terms of the sector. And then we go out and do inspection in that regard as well. Now, the issue, again, which we also are talking to in terms of joint inspections, the question, I think, came out in terms of how successful those inspections are. Now, our inspections, again, are very, very successful. Because, remember, I think here, we definitely partner with relevant departments. In other words, if, for instance, an issue for farming or agriculture, we partner, I think, as we said earlier, with the Department of Home Affairs. But also, I think, we then also take on board another colleague, I mean, sister department of ours, which is the Department of DTI, in terms of checking of the registration of whether those businesses are registered or not. I think, Chairperson, I suppose I've answered the questions. And if there's any issue of clarity, I don't mind to clarify it further. Thanks.
Fortunately, our time is about to be up, but I can give you, if it is a question of clarification.
No, just to give some marching orders. Chairperson, the lady here, I don't know the name, I forgot. She answers, she says a mouthful, a short of inspection. She says a mouthful. So I was saying, if you short inspection, don't elaborate further, because we will crush you because of that thing that we are trying to put. When we raise question here, we know exactly what we are talking about. We ask you the things that we know that we are not capable doing it. So I was just saying, cut it there, my brother. Thank you.
Yes, I think as a government, we've got to make sure that we do not have funded vacancies. I mean that is the problem for many departments. But I think the issue of foreign nationals can be managed better if we make sure that people that ought not to have worked in South Africa are not working in South Africa, and those that ought to work in South Africa work in South Africa. I think that is the short end. It will help everyone. Having said so, I think also as a country we've got to know our responsibilities and rights, balance rights and responsibilities. Well, it applies to me and it applies to everyone. Because sometimes really the way we balance our rights against our responsibilities is not favorable to a great country in many ways. I think South Africans understand what I mean. And but what we have learned is that in as much as we are talking about each other, it is even more important to talk to each other. We need to have this ongoing national dialogue, because a lot of our problems can only be solved by different stakeholders acting together with the aim of making South Africa the greatest country ever. And that is what we should guide us. And then in saying that, I think the issue of conferences and workshops, in as much as it is very important, I think the recommendation has got to be that the CEO has got to meet with the DG and share perspectives. Industry is very important as a job creator, as a revenue earner, and it gives jobs even to people who are semi-skilled and unskilled. And there are small businesses that may find it very difficult to comply with all the laws. But the how now of it, how do we deal with this? I think there has to be a proactive move from even the government and the CEOs of our nation. Government is not against people talking together. So I think if we can have the CEO talking with the DG as a starting point, sharing perspectives about the problems in the industry, that would assist. Another area where the CEO could benefit the whole of South Africa would be having a meeting with SALGA, the ones that control local governments, and then together with COGTA, the Department of Constitutional, what is it called, and Traditional Affairs, the DG, but COGTA, Cooperation and Government, and then have a one-on-one meeting rather than over and above perhaps making sure that the operatives attend conferences and so forth. I think that would assist in moving our country forward. The issue of red tape in tourism, I've not seen that book, but I think it has got to, we've got to have a copy, and then. And then I think also it has got to be said, because the intentions of labor are good and for the welfare of all the people, but in as much as also the intentions of business as well, I mean they do not intend hurting everyone or anyone, but how do we then balance the two in order to make our country a better country? And then there are issues around sound labor relations. Sound labor relations in the long run are good for sustainable tourism, and it is part of motivating workers and so forth. So if we share and then we discuss these things, I think we are going to comply even better. And then our compliance will be meaningful, because also let us remember compliance with laws are better if you understand why the laws were there in the first place. If you say there should be sober driving over weekends, people have got to understand why before you can punish them. And that type of approach. But in conclusion, I think we've got to build a stronger South Africa, a stronger nation. And then it has got to be in our interest to be the best. We've got to strive to be the best nation ever, and the greatest country or on the continent. We may not be the biggest, we may not be the richest, but we can be the greatest country on earth. It is within our grasp, but if we work together. Now I'm trying to avoid this working together, but I think you agree with me that it's difficult sometimes to run away from that. And then it is our responsibility for us to make Africa the greatest continent in the future, so that our children one day inherit a legacy that is pleasant to inherit. I thank you very much on that score. We close the hearing, and then we go to our announcements. A major role player in the industry, that is the Minister of Tourism, is in bereavement. He has lost his mother. And we express our condolences, and I think I'm speaking for all the tourism fraternity here, to the minister and his family for that. And there are arrangements for the funeral, and then in as much as possible as members of parliament, as members of the industry as well, it will be important to show solidarity with the family, either by attending the funeral or in whatever way we see fit. The arrangement is as follows. The date of the funeral of the mother of the minister will be on Thursday, the 2nd of September. The time will be 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The venue will be Deppenville, Dutch Reformed Church, corner of Church and Ware Street, Deppenville. That will be, that is in Cape Town, it's a suburb of Cape Town. So that is, that was our announcement. And I know that we do not have a lot of time here in Parliament. We are busy, but those who can will be there, please, we'll have to do our country service, either by just sending a card or actually getting to the funeral, depending on the need. It will make our minister even more productive after the event. So it's a great loss, because I know that the minister was very much attached to his mother. When she was sick, he kept on talking about the mother and about her condition. So really, I think it has affected him quite deeply. So I think we've got to be in solidarity with the minister during this dark hour. And yes, Mother?
Well, why don't we confirm the question of the card, chairperson? I want to suggest that the committee sends a card and we sign on that card. We have a message and then we sign as a committee. If the card was here, I would say all of us present here, but I suppose because the card is not here, but at least the committee members can sign that card. And then whoever goes there can also take the card on our behalf. It's a proposal.
Thank you very much for that proposal. I think the secretary will organize the card. We shall circulate it to you for you to express your condolences and support to the minister in this hour of need. We shall do so, definitely. We'll move around Parliament as you are sitting there in your seats, and then you have to just to say whatever you want to on that card. And then lastly, I think we have, are we having any other correspondence? So we are not having any correspondence, but we have had submissions for our business plan, which we shall be considering in our management, in our MENCO and management committee meeting, and then we shall recirculate that draft for adoption next week. Would that be okay with you? Okay. And then, but let me also say that the inputs from all members, from all parties, have been enriching our business plan. And thank you very much from everyone who has made a contribution. We really value that. And in conclusion, our role is to do oversight. But oversight is not an end in itself. The end is to make South Africa the best country ever by making sure that we keep on improving on what we are having. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for attending.